her head on her knees and tried to wake up. "Who told you that, Auntie?"
"Mary Webster called at the crack of dawn. Said you two were seen stark in the middle of the river last night at 1 o'clock.
"Anybody with eyes that good was up to no good." Jean Louise shrugged her shoulders.
"Well, Auntie, I suppose I've got to marry Hank now, haven't I?"
I don't know what to think of you, Jean Louise.
Your father will die. Simply die when he finds out. You'd better tell him before he finds out on the street corner.
Atticus was standing in the door with his hands in his pockets. "Good morning," he said. "What'll kill me?"
Alexandra said, "I'm not going to tell him, Jean Louise. It's up to you."
Jean Louise silently signaled her father. Her message was received and understood. Atticus looked grave. "What's the matter?" he said.
"Mary Webster was on the blower. Her advance agent saw Hank and me swimming in the middle of the river last night with no clothes on."
"Hmm," said Atticus. He touched his glasses. "I hope you weren't doing the backstroke."
"Atticus!" said Alexandra.
"Sorry, Xandra," said Atticus.
"Is that true, Jean Louise?"
"Partly. Have I disgraced us beyond repair?"
"We might survive it."
Alexandra sat down on the bed. "Then it's true," she said. "Jean Louise, I don't know what you were doing at the landing last night in the first place."
"But you do know. Mary Webster told you everything, Auntie. Didn't she tell you what happened afterwards?
Throw me my negligee, please, sir."
Atticus threw her pajama bottoms at her. She put them on beneath the sheet, kicked the sheet back, and stretched her legs.
"Jean Louise," said Alexandra and stopped.
Atticus was holding up a rough, dried cotton dress. He put it on the bed and went to the chair. He picked up a rough, dried half-slip, held it up, and dropped it on top of the dress. "Quit tormenting your aunt, Jean Louise. These your swimming togs?"
"Yes, sir. Reckon we ought to take them through town on a pole?"
Alexandra puzzled, fingered Jean Louise's garments, and said,
"But what possessed you to go in with your clothes on?"
When her brother and niece laughed, she said,
"It's not funny at all." "Even if you did go in with your clothes on, Makem won't give you credit for it. You might as well have gone in naked. I cannot imagine what put it in your heads to do such a thing."
"I can't either," said Jean Louise. "Besides, if it's any comfort to you, Auntie,
it wasn't that much fun. We just started teasing each other, and I dared Hank, and he couldn't back out, and then I couldn't back out. And the next thing you know, we were in the water." Alexandra was not impressed.
"At your ages, Jean Louise, such conduct is most unbecoming."
Jean Louise sighed and got out of bed.
"Well, I'm sorry," she said. "Is there any coffee?"
"There's a pot full, waiting for you."
Jean Louise joined her father in the kitchen. She went to the stove, poured herself a cup of coffee, and sat down at the table.
"How can you drink ice-cold milk for breakfast?"
Atticus gulped.
"Tastes better than coffee."
Calpurnia used to say when Jim and I'd beg her for coffee that it'd turn us black like her.
"Are you worn with me?"
Atticus snorted.
"Of course not. But I can think of several more interesting things to do in the middle of the night and pull a trick like that. You better get ready for Sunday school."
Alexandra's Sunday corset was even more formidable than her everyday ones. She stood in the door of Jean Louise's room in armored, hatted, gloved, perfumed, and ready. Sunday was Alexandra's day. In the moments before and after Sunday school, she and 15 other Methodist ladies sat together in the church auditorium and conducted a symposium Jean Louise called The News of the Week in Review. Jean Louise regretted that she had deprived her aunt of her Sabbath pleasure. Today, Alexandra would be on the defensive. But Jean Louise was confident that Alexandra could wage a defensive war with little less tactical genius than her forward thrusts, that she would emerge and listen to the sermon with her niece's reputation intact.
"Jean Louise, are you ready?"
"Almost," she answered. She swiped at her mouth with a lipstick, patted down her cowlick, eased her shoulders, and turned.
"How do I look?" she said.
"I've never seen you completely dressed in your life. Where's your hat?"
"Auntie, you know good and well if I walked into church today with a hat on, they'd think somebody was dead."
The one time she wore a hat was to Jim's funeral.
She didn't know why she did it. But before the funeral, she made Mr. Ginsburg open his store for her, and she picked one out and clapped it on her head, fully aware that Jim would have laughed had he been able to see her, but somehow it made her feel better. Her Uncle Jack was standing on the church steps when they arrived. Dr. John Halefinch was no taller than his niece, who was 5'7". His father had given him a high-bridged nose, a stern nether lip, and high cheekbones. He looked like his sister Alexandra, but their physical resemblance ended at the neck. Dr. Finch was spare, almost spidery. His sister was of firmer proportions. He was the reason Atticus did not marry until he was 40. When the time came for John Halefinch to choose a profession, he chose medicine. He chose to study it at a time when cotton was 1 cent a pound, and the Finches had everything but money. Atticus, not yet secure in his profession, spent and borrowed every nickel he could find to put on his brother's education. In due time, it was returned, with interest. Dr. Finch became a bone man, practiced in Nashville, played the stock market with shrewdness, and by the time he was 45, he had accumulated enough money to retire and devote all his time to his first and abiding love, Victorian literature, a pursuit that in itself earned him the reputation of being Macon County's most learned, licensed eccentric. Dr. Finch had drunk so long and so deep of his heady brew that his being was shot through with curious mannerisms and odd exclamations. He punctuated his speech with little ha's and hums, and archaic expressions on top of which his penchant for modern slang teetered precariously. His wit was hat-pin sharp. He was absent-minded. He was a bachelor, but gave the impression of harboring amusing memories. He possessed a yellow cat, 19 years old. He was incomprehensible to most of Macon County because his conversation was colored with subtle allusions to Victorian obscurities. He gave strangers the idea that he was a borderline case, but those who were tuned to his wavelength knew Dr. Finch to be of a mind so sound, especially when it came to market manipulation, that his friends often risked lengthy lectures on the poetry of Mackworth Praed to seek his advice. From long and close association, in her solitary teens Dr. Finch had tried to make a scholar of her, Jean Louise had developed enough understanding of his subjects to follow him most of the time, and she reveled in his conversation. When he did not have her in silent hysterics, she was bewitched by his bear-trap memory and vast, restless mind. "Good morning, daughter of Nereus," said her uncle as he kissed her on the cheek. One of Dr. Finch's concessions to the 20th century was a telephone. He held his niece at arm's length and regarded her with amused interest. "Home for 19 hours and you've already indulged your predilection for ablutionary excesses. Ha! A classic example of Watsonian behaviorism. Think I'll write you up and send you to the AMA journal." "Hush, old quack," whispered Jean Louise between clenched teeth. "I'm coming to see you this afternoon." "You and Hank mollicking around in the river? Ha! Ought to be ashamed of yourselves. Disgrace to the family. Have fun." Sunday school was beginning, and Dr. Finch bowed her in the door. "Your guilty lover's waiting within," he said. Jean Louise gave her uncle a look which withered him not at all, and marched into the church with as much dignity as she could muster. She smiled and greeted the Macon Methodists, and in her old classroom she settled herself by the window and slept with her eyes open through the lesson, as was her custom. 7. There's nothing like a blood-curdling hymn to make you feel at home, thought Jean Louise. Any sense of isolation she may have had withered and died in the presence of some 200 sinners earnestly requesting to be plunged beneath a red, redeeming flood. While offering to the Lord the results of Mr. Cowper's hallucination, or declaring it was love that lifted her, Jean Louise shared the warmness that prevails among diverse individuals who find themselves in the same boat for 1 hour each week. She was sitting beside her aunt in the middle pew on the right side of the auditorium. Her father and Dr. Finch sat side by side on the left, third row from the front. Why they did it was a mystery to her, but they had sat there together ever since Dr. Finch returned to Macon. Nobody would take them for brothers, she thought. It's hard to believe he's 10 years older than Uncle Jack. Atticus Finch looked like his mother.
Alexandra and John Hale Finch looked like their father. Atticus was a head taller than his brother. His face was broad and open with a straight nose and a wide, thin mouth. But something about the three marked them as kin. Uncle Jack and Atticus are getting white in the same places, and their eyes are alike, thought Jean Louise. That's what it is. She was correct. All the Finches had straight, incisive eyebrows and heavy-lidded eyes. When they looked slantwise, up or straight ahead, a disinterested observer would catch a glimpse of what Makem called family resemblance. Her meditations were interrupted by Henry Clinton. He had passed one collection plate down the pew behind her, and while waiting for its mate to return via the row she was sitting on, he winked openly and solemnly at her. Alexandra saw him and looked blue murder. Henry and his fellow usher walked up the center aisle and stood reverently in front of the altar. Immediately after collection, Makem Methodist sang what they called the doxology in lieu of the minister praying over the collection plate to spare him the rigors involved in inventing yet another prayer, since by that time he had uttered three healthy invocations. From the time of Jean Louise's earliest ecclesiastical recollection, Makem had sung the doxology in one way and in one way only. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. A rendition as much a tradition of Southern Methodism as pounding the preacher. That Sunday, Jean Louise and the congregation were in all innocence clearing their throats to drag it accordingly when out of a cloudless sky Mrs. Clyde Haskins crashed down on the organ. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, all creatures here below. Praise Him above, ye heavenly host. Praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. In the confusion that followed, if the Archbishop of Canterbury had materialized in full regalia, Jean Louise would not have been in the least surprised. The congregation had failed to notice any change in Mrs. Haskins' lifelong interpretation, and they intoned the doxology to its bitter end, as they had been reared to do, while Mrs. Haskins romped madly ahead like something out of Salisbury Cathedral. Jean Louise's first thought was that Herbert Jimson had lost his mind. Herbert Jimson had been music director of the Makem Methodist Church for as long as she could remember. He was a big, good man with a soft baritone, who ruled with easy tact a choir of repressed soloists, and who had an unerring memory for the favorite hymns of district superintendents. In the sundry church wars that were a living part of Makem Methodism, Herbert could be counted on as the one person to keep his head, talk sense, and reconcile the more primitive elements of the congregation with the Young Turk faction. He had devoted 30 years' spare time to his church, and his church had recently rewarded him with a trip to a Methodist music camp in South Carolina. Jean Louise's second impulse was to blame it on the minister. He was a young man, a Mr. Stone by name, with what Dr. Finch called the greatest talent for dullness he had ever seen in a man on the near side of 50. There was nothing whatever wrong with Mr. Stone, except that he possessed all the necessary qualifications for a certified public accountant. He did not like people. He was quick with numbers. He had no sense of humor, and he was butt-headed. Because Makem's church had for years not been large enough for a good minister, but too big for a mediocre one, Makem was delighted when, at the last church conference, the authorities decided to send its Methodists an energetic young one. But after less than a year, the young minister had impressed his congregation to a degree that moved Dr. Finch to observe, absently and audibly one Sunday, "We asked for bread, and they gave us a stone." Mr. Stone had long been suspected of liberal tendencies. He was too friendly, some thought, with his Yankee brethren. He had recently emerged partially damaged from a controversy over the Apostles' Creed. And worst of all, he was thought to be ambitious. Jean Louise was building up an airtight case against him when she remembered Mr. Stone was tone-deaf. Unruffled by Herbert Jemson's breach of allegiance, because he had not heard it, Mr. Stone rose and walked to the pulpit with Bible in hand. He opened it and said, "My text for today is taken from the 21st chapter of Isaiah, verse 6. For thus hath the Lord said unto me, Go, set a watchman.
Let him declare what he seeth. Jean Louise made a sincere effort to listen to what Mr. Stone's watchman saw, but in spite of her efforts to quell it, she felt amusement turning into indignant displeasure, and she stared straight at Herbert Jimson throughout the service. How dare he change it? Was he trying to lead them back to the Mother Church? Had she allowed reason to rule, she would have realized that Herbert Jimson was Methodist of the whole cloth. He was notoriously short on theology and a mile long on good works. The doxology's gone. They'll be having incense next. Orthodoxy's my doxy. Did Uncle Jack say that, or was it one of his old bishops? She looked across the aisle toward him and saw the sharp edge of his profile. He's in a snit, she thought. Mr. Stone droned. A Christian can rid himself of the frustrations of modern living by coming to family night every Wednesday and bringing a covered dish. Abide with you now and forevermore. Amen. Mr. Stone had pronounced the benediction and was on his way to the front door when she went down the aisle to corner Herbert, who had remained behind to shut the windows. Dr. Finch was faster on the draw.
Shouldn't sing it like that, Herbert, he was saying. We are Methodists, after all, D.V. Don't look at me, Dr. Finch. Herbert threw up his hands as if to ward off whatever was coming. It's the way they told us to sing it, at Camp Charles Wesley. You aren't going to take something like that lying down, are you? Who told you to do that?
Dr. Finch screwed up his underlip until it was almost invisible and released it with a snap.
The music instructor. He taught a course in what was wrong with Southern church music. He was from New Jersey, said Herbert. He did he?
Yes, sir.
What did he say was wrong with it?
Herbert said.
He said we might as well be singing Stick Your Snout Under the Spout Where the Gospel Comes Out, as most of the hymns we sang. Said they ought to ban Fanny Crosby by church law, and that Rock of Ages was an abomination unto the Lord.
Indeed?
He said we ought to pep up the doxology.
Pep it up? How?
Like we sang it today.
Dr. Finch sat down in the front pew. He slung his arm across the back and moved his fingers meditatively. He looked up at Herbert.
Apparently, he said, our brethren in the Northland are not content merely with the Supreme Court's activities. They are now trying to change our hymns on us.
Herbert said.
He told us we ought to get rid of the Southern hymns and learn some other ones. I don't like it. Ones he thought were pretty don't even have tunes.
Dr. Finch's ha was crisper than usual, a sure sign that his temper was going. He retrieved it sufficiently to say,
Southern hymns, Herbert? Southern hymns?
Dr. Finch put his hands on his knees and straightened his spine to an upright position.
Now, Herbert, he said, let us sit quietly in this sanctuary and analyze this calmly. I believe your man wishes us to sing the doxology down the line with nothing less than the Church of England, yet he reverses himself, and wants to throw out abide with me? Right?
Light.
Sir? Light, sir. Light. What about when I survey the wondrous cross?
Well, that's another one, said Herbert. He gave us a list.
Gave you a list, did he? I suppose Onward Christian Soldiers is on it?
At the top.
Her, said Dr. Finch.
H.F. Light. Isaac Watts. Sabine Baring Gould.
Dr. Finch rolled out the last name in Macomb County accents. Long A's, I's, and a pause between syllables.
Everyone an Englishman, Herbert.
Good and true, he said.
Wants to throw them out, yet tries to make us sing the doxology like we were all in Westminster Abbey, does he?
Well, let me tell you something. Jean Louise looked at Herbert, who was nodding agreement, and at her uncle, who was looking like Theobald Pontifex.
Your man's a snob, Herbert, and that's a fact.
He was sort of a sissy, said Herbert.
I'll bet he was.
Are you going along with all this nonsense?
Heavens no, said Herbert.
I thought I'd try it once, just to make sure of what I already guessed. Congregation'll never learn it. Besides, I like the old ones.
So do I, Herbert, said Dr. Finch.
He rose and hooked his arm through Jean Louise's.
I'll see you this time next Sunday, and if I find this church risen 1 foot off the ground, I'll hold you personally responsible.
Something in Dr. Finch's eyes told Herbert that this was a joke. He laughed and said,
Don't worry, sir.
Dr. Finch walked his niece to the car, where Atticus and Alexandra were waiting. Want a lift? She said.
Of course not, said Dr. Finch.
It was his habit to walk to and from church every Sunday, and this he did, undeterred by tempest, boiling sun, or freezing weather. As he turned to go, Jean Louise called to him.
Uncle Jack, she said. What does DV mean?
Dr. Finch sighed his "You have no education, young woman," sigh, raised his eyebrows and said,
Deo volente. God willing, child. God willing. A reliable Catholic utterance.
8. With the same suddenness that a barbarous boy yanks the larva of an antlion from its hole to leave it struggling in the sun, Jean Louise was snatched from her quiet realm and left alone to protect her sensitive epidermis as best she could, on a humid Sunday afternoon at precisely 2:28 p.m. The circumstances leading to the event were these. After dinner, at which time Jean Louise regaled her household with Dr. Finch's observations on stylish hymn singing, Atticus sat in his corner of the living room reading the Sunday papers, and Jean Louise was looking forward to an afternoon's hilarity with her uncle, complete with tea cakes and the strongest coffee in Macomb. The doorbell rang. She heard Atticus call, Come in, and Henry's voice answer him. Ready, Mr. Finch? She threw down the dish towel. Before she could leave the kitchen, Henry stuck his head in the door and said, Hey. Alexandra pinned him to the wall in no time flat.
Henry Clinton, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Henry, whose charms were not inconsiderable, turned them full force on Alexandra, who showed no signs of melting.
Now, Miss Alexandra, he said, you can't stay mad with us long, even if you try.
Alexandra said, I got you two out of it this time, but I may not be around next time.
Miss Alexandra, we appreciate that more than anything.
He turned to Jean Louise.
7:30 tonight, and no landing.
We'll go to the show.
Okay. Where are you all going?
Courthouse meeting.
On Sunday?
Yep. That's right. I keep forgetting all the politicking's done on Sunday in these parts. Atticus called for Henry to come on.
Bye, baby, he said.
Jean Louise followed him into the living room. When the front door slammed behind her father and Henry, she went to her father's chair to tidy up the papers he had left on the floor beside it. She picked them up, arranged them in sectional order, and put them on the sofa in a neat pile. She crossed the room again to straighten the stack of books on his lamp table, and was doing so when a pamphlet the size of a business envelope caught her eye. On its cover was a drawing of an anthropophagous Negro. Above the drawing was printed The Black Plague. Its author was somebody with several academic degrees after his name. She opened the pamphlet, sat down in her father's chair, and began reading. When she had finished, she took the pamphlet by one of its corners, held it like she would hold a dead rat by the tail, and walked into the kitchen. She held the pamphlet in front of her aunt.
What is this thing? She said.
Alexandra looked over her glasses at it.
Something of your father's.
Jean Louise stepped on the garbage can trigger and threw the pamphlet in.
Don't do that, said Alexandra. They're hard to come by these days.
Jean Louise opened her mouth, shut it, and opened it again.
Auntie, have you read that thing? Do you know what's in it?
Certainly.
If Alexandra had uttered an obscenity in her face, Jean Louise would have been less surprised.
You? Auntie, do you know the stuff in that thing makes Dr. Goebbels look like a naive little country boy?
I don't know what you're talking about, Jean Louise. There are a lot of truths in that book.
Yes, indeedy, said Jean Louise wryly.
I especially liked the part where the Negroes, bless their hearts, couldn't help being inferior to the white race because their skulls are thicker and their brain pans shallower, whatever that means. So we must all be very kind to them and not let them do anything to hurt themselves and keep them in their places.
Good God, Auntie!
Alexandra was ramrod straight.
Well,
she said. Jean Louise said, it's just that I never knew you went in for salacious reading material, Auntie. Her aunt was silent, and Jean Louise continued.
I was real impressed with the parable where since the dawn of history, the rulers of the world have always been white, except Genghis Khan or somebody. The author was real fair about that, and he made a killing point about even the pharaohs were white and their subjects were either black or Jews.
That's true, isn't it?
Sure, but what's that got to do with the case?
When Jean Louise felt apprehensive, expectant, or on edge, especially when confronting her aunt, her brain clicked to the meter of Gilbertian tomfoolery. Three sprightly figures whirled madly in her head. Hours filled with Uncle Jack and Dill dancing to preposterous measures blacked out the coming of tomorrow with tomorrow's troubles. Alexandra was talking to her.
I told you, it's something your father brought home from a citizens' council meeting.
From a what?
From the Macomb County Citizens' Council. Didn't you know we have one?
I did not.
Well, your father's on the board of directors, and Henry's one of the staunchest members,
Alexandra sighed.
Not that we really need one. Nothing's happened here in Macomb yet, but it's always wise to be prepared. That's where they are this minute.
Citizens' Council? In Macomb?
Jean Louise heard herself repeating fatuously.
Atticus?
Alexandra said, Jean Louise, I don't think you fully realize what's been going on down here.
Jean Louise turned on her heel, walked to the front door, out of it, across the broad front yard, down the street towards town as fast as she could go.
Alexandra's, you aren't going to town like that,
echoing behind her. She had forgotten that there was a car in good running condition in the garage, that its keys were on the hall table. She walked swiftly, keeping time to the absurd jingle running through her head.
Here's a howdy-do. If I marry you, when your time has come to perish, then the maiden whom you cherish must be slaughtered too. Here's a howdy-do.
What were Hank and Atticus up to? What was going on? She did not know, but before the sun went down, she would find out. It had something to do with that pamphlet she found in the house, sitting there before God and everybody. Something to do with citizens' councils. She knew about them all right. New York papers full of it. She wished she had paid more attention to them. But only one glance down a column of print was enough to tell her a familiar story. Same people who were the Invisible Empire, who hated Catholics. Ignorant, fear-ridden, red-faced, boorish, law-abiding, 100% red-blooded Anglo-Saxons, her fellow Americans. Trash. Atticus and Hank were pulling something. They were there merely to keep an eye on things. Auntie said Atticus was on the board of directors. She was wrong. It was all a mistake. Auntie got mixed up on her facts sometimes. She slowed up when she came to the town. It was deserted. Only two cars were in front of the drugstore. The old courthouse stood white in the afternoon glare. A black hound loped down the street in the distance. The monkey puzzles bristled silently on the corners of the square. When she went to the north side entrance, she saw empty cars standing in a double row, the length of the building. When she went up the courthouse steps, she missed the elderly men who loitered there. She missed the water cooler that stood inside the door. Missed the cane-bottom chairs in the hallway. She did not miss the dank urine-sweet odor of Sunless County cubbyholes. She walked past the offices of the tax collector, tax assessor, county clerk, registrar, judge of probate, up old unpainted stairs to the courtroom floor, up a small covered stairway to the colored balcony, walked out into it, and took her old place in the corner of the front row, where she and her brother had sat when they went to court to watch their father. Below her, on rough benches, sat not only most of the trash in Macomb County, but the county's most respectable men. She looked toward the far end of the room,
and behind the railing that separated court from spectators, at a long table, sat her father, Henry Clinton, several men she knew only too well, and a man she did not know. At the end of the table, sitting like a great tropical gray slug, was William Willoughby, the political symbol of everything her father and men like him despised. He's the last of his kind, she thought. Atticus had scarcely given the time of day, and there he is at the same... William Willoughby was indeed the last of his kind, for a while at least. He was bleeding slowly to death in the midst of abundance, for his life's blood was poverty. Every county in the Deep South had a Willoughby, each so like the other that they constituted a category called he, the great big man, the little man, allowing for minor territorial differences. He, or whatever his subjects called him, occupied the leading administrative office in his county. Usually he was sheriff or judge or probate, but there were mutations, like Makem's Willoughby, who chose to grace no public office. Willoughby was rare. His preference to remain behind the scenes implied the absence of vast personal conceit, a trait essential for twopenny despots. Willoughby chose to run the county, not in its most comfortable office, but in what was best described as a hutch, a small, dark, evil-smelling room, with his name on the door, containing nothing more than a telephone, a kitchen table, and unpainted captain's chairs of rich patina. Wherever Willoughby went, there followed axiomatically a coterie of passive, mostly negative characters, known as the courthouse crowd. Specimens Willoughby had put into the various county and municipal offices to do as they were told. Sitting at the table by Willoughby was one of them, Tom Carl Joyner, his right-hand man and justly proud. Wasn't he in with Willoughby from the beginning? Did he not do all of Willoughby's legwork? Did he not, in the old days during the Depression, knock on tenant cabin doors at midnight? Did he not drum it into the head of every ignorant, hungry wretch who accepted public assistance, whether job or relief money, that his vote was Willoughby's? No votee, no eatee. Like his lesser satellites, over the years Tom Carl had assumed an ill-fitting air of respectability and did not care to be reminded of his nefarious beginnings. Tom Carl sat that Sunday secure in the knowledge that the small empire he had lost so much sleep building would be his when Willoughby lost interest or died. Nothing in Tom Carl's face indicated that he might have a rude surprise coming to him. Already, prosperity-bred independence had undermined his kingdom until it was foundering. Two more elections and it would crumble into thesis material for a sociology major. Jean Louise watched his self-important little face and almost laughed when she reflected that the South was indeed pitiless to reward its public servants with extinction. She looked down on rows of familiar heads, white hair, brown hair, hair carefully combed to hide no hair. And she remembered how, long ago when court was dull, she would quietly aim spitballs at the shining domes below. Judge Taylor caught her at it one day and threatened her with a bench warrant. The courthouse clock creaked, strained, said, "Plum," and struck the hour. 2. When the sound shivered away, she saw her father rise and address the assembly in his dry courtroom voice. "Gentlemen, our speaker for today is Mr. Grady O'Hanlon. He needs no introduction. Mr. O'Hanlon." Mr. O'Hanlon rose and said, "As the cow said to the milkman on a cold morning, thank you for the warm hand." She had never seen or heard of Mr. O'Hanlon in her life. From the gist of his introductory remarks, however, Mr. O'Hanlon made plain to her who he was. He was an ordinary, God-fearing man, just like any ordinary man, who had quit his job to devote his full time to the preservation of segregation. Well, some people have strange fancies, she thought. Mr. O'Hanlon had light brown hair, blue eyes, a mulish face, a shocking necktie, and no coat. He unbuttoned his collar, untied his tie, blinked his eyes,
ran his hand through his hair, and got down to business. Mr. O'Hanlon was born and bred in the South, went to school there, married a Southern lady, lived all his life there, and his main interest today was to uphold the Southern way of life. And no niggers and no Supreme Court was going to tell him or anybody else what to do. A race as hammer-headed as essential inferiority. Kinky woolly heads. Still in the trees. Greasy smelly. Marry your daughters. Mongrelize the race. Mongrelize. Mongrelize. Save the South. Black Monday. Lower than cockroaches. God made the races. Nobody knows why, but he intended for them to stay apart. If he hadn't, he'd have made us all one color. Back to Africa. She heard her father's voice, a tiny voice talking in the warm, comfortable past. Gentlemen, if there's one slogan in this world I believe, it is this. Equal rights for all. Special privileges for none. These topwater nigger preachers, like apes, mouths like number two cans, twist the gospel. The court prefers to listen to communists. Take them all out and shoot them for treason. Against Mr. O'Hanlon's humming harangue, a memory was rising to dispute him. The courtroom shifted imperceptibly. In it, she looked down on the same heads. When she looked across the room, a jury sat in the box. Judge Taylor was on the bench. His pilot fish sat below in front of him, writing steadily. Her father was on his feet. He had risen from a table at which she could see the back of a kinky, woolly head. Atticus Finch rarely took a criminal case. He had no taste for criminal law. The only reason he took this one was because he knew his client to be innocent of the charge, and he could not for the life of him let the black boy go to prison because of a half-hearted, court-appointed defense. The boy had come to him by way of Calpurnia, told him his story, and had told him the truth. The truth was ugly. Atticus took his career in his hands, made good use of a careless indictment, took his stand before a jury, and accomplished what was never before or afterwards done in Macomb County. He won an acquittal for a colored boy on a rape charge. The chief witness for the prosecution was a white girl. Atticus had two weighty advantages. Although the white girl was 14 years of age, the defendant was not indicted for statutory rape. Therefore, Atticus could, and did prove, consent. Consent was easier to prove than under normal conditions. The defendant had only one arm. The other was chopped off in a sawmill accident. Atticus pursued the case to its conclusion with every spark of his ability, and with an instinctive distaste so bitter, only his knowledge that he could live peacefully with himself was able to wash it away. After the verdict, he walked out of the courtroom in the middle of the day, walked home, and took a steaming bath. He never counted what it cost him. He never looked back. He never knew two pairs of eyes like his own were watching him from the balcony. Not the question of whether snot-nosed niggers will go to school with your children or ride the front of the bus. It's whether Christian civilization will continue to be or whether we will be slaves of the communists. Nigger lawyers. Stomped on the Constitution. Our Jewish friends. Killed Jesus. Voted the nigger. Our granddaddies. Nigger judges and sheriffs. Separate is equal. 95% of the tax money. For the nigger and the old hound dog. Following the golden calf. Preach the gospel. Old Lady Roosevelt, nigger lover, entertains 45 niggers but not one fresh white Southern virgin. Huey Long, that Christian gentleman, black as burnt lighted knots, bribed the Supreme Court, decent white Christians,
Was Jesus crucified for the nigger?
Jean Louise's hand slipped. She removed it from the balcony railing and looked at it. It was dripping wet. A wet place on the railing mirrored thin light coming through the upper windows. She stared at her father sitting to the right of Mr. O'Hanlon, and she did not believe what she saw. She stared at Henry sitting to the left of Mr. O'Hanlon, and she did not believe what she saw. But they were sitting all over the courtroom, men of substance and character, responsible men, good men, men of all varieties and reputations. It seemed that the only man in the county not present was Uncle Jack. Uncle Jack, she was supposed to go see him sometime. When? She knew little of the affairs of men, but she knew what her father's presence at the table with a man who spewed filth from his mouth. Did that make it less filthy? No. It condoned. She felt sick. Her stomach shut. She began to tremble. Hank. Every nerve in her body shrieked, then died. She was numb. She pulled herself to her feet clumsily and stumbled from the balcony down the covered staircase. She did not hear her feet scraping down the broad stairs or the courthouse clock laboriously strike 2:30. She did not feel the dank air of the first floor. The glaring sun pierced her eyes with pain, and she put her hands to her face. When she took them down slowly to adjust her eyes from dark to light, she saw Makeham, with no people in it, shimmering in the steaming afternoon. She walked down the steps and into the shade of a live oak. She put her arm out and leaned against the trunk. She looked at Makeham, and her throat tightened. Makeham was looking back at her.
Go away, the old building said. There's no place for you here. You're not wanted. We have secrets.
In obedience to them, in the silent heat, she walked down Makeham's main thoroughfare, a highway leading to Montgomery. She walked on, past houses with wide front yards in which moved green-thumbed ladies and slow, large men. She thought she heard Mrs. Wheeler yelling to Miss Maudie Atkinson across the street, and if Miss Maudie saw her, she would say, "Come in and have some cake. I've just made a big one for the doctor, and a little one for you." She counted the cracks in the sidewalk, steeled herself for Mrs. Henry Lafayette DeBose's onslaught.
"Don't you say hey to me, Jean Louise Finch. You say good afternoon."
Hurried by the old steep-roofed house, past Miss Rachel's, and found herself home. Homemade ice cream. She blinked hard. I'm losing my mind, she thought. She tried to walk on, but it was too late. The square, squat, modern ice cream shop where her old home had been was open, and a man was peering out the window at her. She dug in the pockets of her slacks and came up with a quarter. "Could I have a cone of vanilla, please?"
"Don't come in cones no more. I can give you a..."
"That's all right. Give me whatever it comes in," she said to the man.
"Jean Louise Finch, ain't you?" he said.
"Yes."
"Used to live right here, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Matter of fact, born here, weren't you?"
"Yes."
"Been living in New York, haven't you?"
"Yes."
"Makeham's changed, ain't it?"
"Yes."
"Don't remember who I am, do you?"
"No."
"Well, I ain't gonna tell you. You can just sit there and eat your ice cream and try to figure out who I am. And if you can, I'll give you another helping, free of charge."
"Thank you, sir," she said.
"Do you mind if I go around in the back?"
"Sure.
There's tables and chairs out in the back. Folks sit out there at night and eat their ice cream."
The backyard was strewn over with white gravel. How small it looks with no house, no car house, no chinaberry trees, she thought. She sat down at a table and put the container of ice cream on it.
"I've got to think."
It happened so quickly that her stomach was still heaving. She breathed deeply to quieten it, but it would not stay still. She felt herself turning green with nausea, and she put her head down. Try as she might, she could not think. She only knew, and what she knew was this. The one human being she had ever fully and wholeheartedly trusted had failed her. The only man she had ever known to whom she could point and say, with expert knowledge, "He is a gentleman. In his heart, he is a gentleman," had betrayed her, publicly, grossly, and shamelessly. 9. Integrity, humor, and patience were the three words for Atticus Finch. There was also a phrase for him. Pick at random any citizen from Macomb County and its environs. Ask him what he thought of Atticus Finch, and the answer would most likely be, "I never had a better friend." Atticus Finch's secret of living was so simple it was deeply complex. Where most men had codes and tried to live up to them, Atticus lived his to the letter, with no fuss, no fanfare, and no soul-searching. His private character was his public character. His code was simple New Testament ethic. Its rewards were the respect and devotion of all who knew him. Even his enemies loved him, because Atticus never acknowledged that they were his enemies. He was never a rich man, but he was the richest man his children ever knew. His children were in a position to know, as children seldom are. When Atticus was in the legislature, he met, loved, and married a Montgomery girl, some 15 years his junior. He brought her home to Macomb, and they lived in a new-bought house on the town's main street. When Atticus was 42, their son was born, and they named him Jeremy Atticus for his father and his father's father. 4 years later, their daughter was born, and they named her Jean Louise for her mother and her mother's mother. 2 years after that, Atticus came home from work one evening and found his wife on the floor of the front porch, dead, cut off from view by the wisteria vine that made the corner of the porch a cool private retreat. She had not been dead long. The chair from which she had fallen was still rocking. Jean Graham Finch had brought to the family the heart that killed her son 22 years later on the sidewalk in front of his father's office. At 48, Atticus was left with two small children and a Negro cook named Calpurnia. It is doubtful that he ever sought for meanings. He merely reared his children as best he could, and in terms of the affection his children felt for him, his best was indeed good. He was never too tired to play keep away. He was never too busy to invent marvelous stories. He was never too absorbed in his own problems to listen earnestly to a tale of woe. Every night he read aloud to them until his voice cracked. Atticus killed several birds with one stone when he read to his children, and would probably have caused a child psychologist considerable dismay. He read to Jim and Jean Louise whatever he happened to be reading, and the children grew up possessed of an obscure erudition. They cut their back teeth on military history, bills to be enacted into laws, true detective mysteries, the Code of Alabama, the Bible, and Palgrave's Golden Treasury. Wherever Atticus went, Jim and Jean Louise would most of the time follow. He took them to Montgomery with him if the legislature was in summer session. He took them to football games, to political meetings, to church, to the office at night if he had to work late. After the sun went down, Atticus was seldom seen in public without his children in tow. Jean Louise had never known her mother, and she never knew what a mother was, but she rarely felt the need of one. In her childhood, her father had never misinterpreted her, nor bobbled once, except when she was 11 and came home to dinner from school one day and found that her blood had begun to flow. She thought she was dying, and she began to scream. Calpurnia and Atticus and Jim came running, and when they saw her plight, Atticus and Jim looked helplessly at Calpurnia, and Calpurnia took her in hand. It had never fully occurred to Jean Louise that she was a girl. Her life had been one of reckless pummeling activity, fighting, football, climbing, keeping up with Jim, and besting anyone her own age in any contest requiring physical prowess. When she was calm enough to listen, She considered that a cruel practical joke had been played upon her. She must now go into a world of femininity, a world she despised, could not comprehend nor defend herself against, a world that did not want her. Jim left her when he was 16. He began slicking back his hair with water and dating girls, and her only friend was Atticus. Then Dr. Finch came home. The two aging men saw her through her loneliest and most difficult hours, through the malignant limbo of turning from a howling tomboy into a young woman. Atticus took her air rifle from her hand and put a golf club in it. Dr. Finch taught her. Dr. Finch taught her what he was most interested in. She gave lip service to the world. She went through the motions of complying with the regulations governing the behavior of teenaged girls from good families. She developed a halfway interest in clothes, boys, hairdos, gossip, and female aspirations. But she was uneasy all the time she was away from the security of those who she knew loved her. Atticus sent her to a woman's college in Georgia. When she finished, he said it was high time she started shifting for herself. And why didn't she go to New York or somewhere? She was vaguely insulted and felt she was being turned out of her own house. But as the years passed, she recognized the full value of Atticus's wisdom. He was growing old, and he wanted to die safe in the knowledge that his daughter could fend for herself. She did not stand alone, but what stood behind her, the most potent moral force in her life, was the love of her father. She never questioned it, never thought about it, never even realized that, before she made any decision of importance, the reflex, what would Atticus do, passed through her unconscious. She never realized what made her dig in her feet and stand firm whenever she did was her father. That whatever was decent and of good report in her character was put there by her father. She did not know that she worshipped him. All she knew was that she felt sorry for the people her age who railed against their parents for not giving them this and cheating them out of that. She felt sorry for middle-aged matrons who, after much analysis, discovered that the seat of their anxiety was in their seats. She felt sorry for persons who called their fathers my old man, denoting that they were raffish, probably boozy, ineffective creatures who had disappointed their children dreadfully and unforgivably somewhere along the line. She was extravagant with her pity and complacent in her snug world. 10. Jean Louise got up from the yard chair she was sitting in, walked to the corner of the lot, and vomited up her Sunday dinner. Her fingers caught the strands of a wire fence, the fence that separated Miss Rachel's garden from the Finch backyard. If Dill were here, he would leap over the fence to her, bring her head down to his, kiss her, and hold her hand, and together they would take their stand when there was trouble in the house. But Dill had long since gone from her. Her nausea returned with redoubled violence when she remembered the scene in the courthouse, but she had nothing left to part with. If you had only spat in my face. It could be, might be, still was, a horrible mistake. Her mind refused to register what her eyes and ears told it. She returned to her chair and sat staring at a pool of melted vanilla ice cream, working its way slowly to the edge of the table. It spread, paused, dribbled, and dripped. Drip, drip, drip. Into the white gravel until, saturated, it could no longer receive, and a second tiny pool appeared. You did that. You did it as sure as you were sitting there. Guess my name yet? Why, look at yonder. You've wasted your ice cream. She raised her head. The man in the shop was leaning out the back window, less than 5 feet from her. He withdrew and reappeared with a limp rag. As he wiped the mess away, he said, What's my name? Rumpelstiltskin. Oh, I am sorry. She looked at the man carefully. Are you one of the C.O. Conninghams? The man grinned broadly. Almost. I'm one of the C.U.'s. How'd you know? Family resemblance. What got you out of the woods?
Mama left me some timber and I sold it. Put up this shop here.
What time is it? She asked.
Getting on to 4:30, said Mr. Cunningham. She rose, smiled goodbye, and said she would be coming back soon. She made her way to the sidewalk. 2 solid hours, and I didn't know where I was. I am so tired. She did not return by town. She walked the long way round, through a schoolyard, down a street lined with pecan trees, across another schoolyard, across a football field on which Jim, in a daze, had once tackled his own man. I am so tired. Alexandra was standing in the doorway. She stepped aside to let Jean Louise pass.
Where have you been? She said. Jack called ages ago and asked after you. Have you been visiting out of the family like that?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? Jean Louise, talk some sense and go phone your uncle.
She went wearily to the telephone and said, 119. Dr. Finch's voice said,
Dr. Finch.
She said softly, I'm sorry. See you tomorrow? Dr. Finch said, right. She was too tired to be amused at her uncle's telephone manners. He viewed such instruments with deep anger, and his conversations were monosyllabic at best. When she turned around, Alexandra said,
You look right puny. What's the matter?
Madam, my father has left me flopping like a flounder at a low tide, and you say, what's the matter? Stomach, she said.
There's a lot of that going around now. Does it hurt?
Yes, it hurts. Like hell. It hurts so much I can't stand it.
No, ma'am. Just upset. Then why don't you take an Alka-Seltzer?
Jean Louise said she would. And the day dawned for Alexandra.
Jean Louise, did you go to that meeting with all those men there?
Yes'm.
Like that?
Yes'm.
Where did you sit?
In the balcony. They didn't see me. I watched from the balcony. Auntie, when Hank comes tonight, tell him I'm indisposed.
Indisposed?
She could not stand there another minute.
Yes, Auntie. I'm gonna do what every Christian young, white, fresh Southern virgin does when she's indisposed. And what might that be?
I'm taken to my bed. Jean Louise went to her room, shut the door, unbuttoned her blouse, unzipped the fly of her slacks, and fell across her mother's lacy, wrought-iron bed. She groped blindly for a pillow and pushed it under her face. In 1 minute, she was asleep. Had she been able to think, Jean Louise might have prevented events to come by considering the day's occurrences in terms of a recurring story as old as time. The chapter which concerned her began 200 years ago and was played out in a proud society the bloodiest war and harshest peace in modern history could not destroy. Returning, to be played out again on a private ground, in the twilight of a civilization no wars and no peace could save. Had she insight, could she have pierced the barriers of her highly selective insular world, she may have discovered that all her life she had been with a visual defect which had gone unnoticed and neglected by herself and by those closest to her. She was born colorblind. Part 4. 11. There was a time, long ago, when the only peaceful moments of her existence were those from the time she opened her eyes in the morning until she attained full consciousness, a matter of seconds until when finally roused she entered the day's wakeful nightmare. She was in the 6th grade, a grade memorable for the things she learned in class and out. That year, the small group of town children were swamped temporarily by a collection of elderly pupils shipped in from Old Sarum because somebody had set fire to the school there. The oldest boy in Miss Blunt's 6th grade was nearly 19, and he had 3 contemporaries. There were several girls of 16, voluptuous, happy creatures, who thought school something of a holiday from chopping cotton and feeding livestock. Miss Blunt was equal to them all. She was as tall as the tallest boy in the class, and twice as wide.